Values are what decides an individual. It is what we value in life. I think most people value valuables, but the spiritual literature says that what is more important is the spiritual values, the teachings that have been emphasized in all the scriptures. Whether you look at the Ten Commandments, you look at the Dhammapada of Buddhism, where he has the eight laws of living. In the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna had given us certain qualities and values that one should live. So in the 16th chapter also, he distinguishes between people who are spiritual and people who are materialistic. He calls the spiritual people devas, the ones whose goal is spiritual growth. And the majority of us, or most of us, who practice a life of materialism, acquiring, possessing, working. And some once in a while, maybe on Sunday we go to the temple, or go once in a while and to the church or pray. Then such people, he calls them as asuras, not divine, but the people who are materialistic, whose life is only geared towards material growth and uptake and intake. So that is what we have to determine. What is more important in my life, valuables, which one is more important? So as we see in the beginning of the 16th chapter, Sri Krishna gives us 26 values that are the hallmarks of spiritual people. And in the last 2 weeks, we had done 9, which was verse number 1. One was fearlessness, purity of mind, firm established in the knowledge, charity, control of the mind, and yajna, austerities, and offering to the Lord. Swadhyaya is self-study. Tapa is practicing self-denial, and arjavam, straightforwardness. So these we had covered in the last 2 weeks. So today we shall continue, and I have put 7 values on the board. In the second verse, there are 11. So we'll be doing the values that are listed on the board. So let's chant the second verse.
Ahimsa satyam akrodaha.
Tyaga
shantirapaishunam. Daya bhuteshvalo luptvam. Mardavam hrira chapalam.
So we'll just list them, and then we'll see how many we can cover today. Ahimsa is non-violence. That we are all familiar with, has been popularized by Gandhiji and then Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela and so on. So ahimsa, non-violence. Satyam is truthfulness. Akrodha is absence of anger. Tyaga is renunciation, sacrifice. Shanti means peace. Apaishunam is absence of crookedness, here mostly pertaining to speech. We had done Arjavam last week, where they talked about straightforwardness in our actions. Here, lack of crookedness in speech or control of the tongue. Daya bhuteshu, compassion for all beings. And then there are a few more that we won't cover today. Aloluktvam. Aloluktvam means absence of covetedness. When you covet somebody else's wealth, when you try to get what you don't have, I not only get what I want, but I want to get my neighbor's or my competitor's wealth. That is called loluktvam. So absence of covetousness is called aloluktvam. Mardavam is gentleness in one's actions. He is modesty, living a life of modesty. And achapalam. Chapalam is excessive activity. So achapalam is not being restless, lack of restlessness. So let us cover one at a time. Ahimsa is the one we'll spend some time on, because himsa is considered as violence. So ahimsa is non-violence or lack of violence. Now, how can we hurt somebody? Of course, one very obvious way is, you know, you slap somebody or you shoot them with a gun or a knife, or physically you hurt somebody or damage their property. That is physical violence, that is in action. But then there are two other ahimsas here. We have violence in thought and violence in speech. Speech is actually very interesting, because if you slap somebody or you hurt somebody, maybe that, you know, the injury on the face, or it might heal in a few days, in a few weeks. But if you have hurt somebody with your speech, said something which is very cruel, very malicious, very hurtful, the pain of that can last for weeks, months, even years. People never forget, you know, so that so and so in 2012, you said that to me, and I can never forget that. So one has to be very careful, not only in action, but also in speech. That's why they said, we tell our children, think before you speak. Because instinctively just reacting and saying something, especially in anger, we'll talk about anger later on, saying something in what you did not mean, or sometimes what happens is that we just lose control over our speech, and then we just say things that we shouldn't have said. And then later on, you cannot take it back. You cannot take, you know, what you have said. You might say, I'm sorry. You might apologize. Maybe you might make up for it. But the hurt of speech, so one has to be very careful in speech, in being non-violent in speech. Then thought, you know, people don't think of thoughts as being violent. You know, they say, what's wrong if I think evil about somebody? But they say that the thoughts create a negative vibrations, not only in your personality, but outwardly. If you think negatively about somebody, if you think in an angry way, if you think in a violent way about somebody, what it will do is create a negative energy, negative vibrations around you. And that will eventually, the other person will come to know. If I'm thinking bad about somebody, I cannot hide it. Eventually, it will come out, you know, in my involuntary actions, in my facial expression, in something I say. And actually, violence ultimately starts in thought. When I think violently about somebody, then I may speak violent and then I may act violent. So one has to be very cautious. In fact, they say that even thinking negative about somebody, you are creating negative karmas. The person may never know it. You may be a very good actor. You may not be able to even let the person see that you are thinking negatively. But within yourself, you are creating negative karmas. So that's why they say one has to be very careful about what you think. Because the moment you think negative, then you are creating those kind of negative. You know, it's like you're starting a chain of, and then that negative vibrations, you know, goes around you. Even if the person may not know, but if you are angry, if you are, you know, hostile, then sooner or later that whole energy in your whole field becomes that. And then you become a source of negativity in your. In fact, there's a Muniji who comes here once a year. I haven't seen him last 2-3 years, but he used to be very particular about that. I remember very clearly him saying that, be very gentle in your thoughts. Be very cautious about what you think. Even if nobody knows it, even you know it, but the Lord within me knows. And so why should I create negativity? So be very cautious. And Gurudev in his commentary says, ahimsa is mental. It's not physical. Because to live without physical violence is impossible. You cannot live on this earth without hurting beings. Even when you're eating, you say, okay, I'm a vegetarian, I don't kill animals, but you're eating plants. So there is some violence. You know, you are destroying some plants, somebody's plucking those plants, whether it's a fruit or a vegetable. When in your garden, you know, there are weeds are growing, and you say, I'm going to be non-violent, I'm not going to hurt. No, you can't, because then the weeds will take over and all your beautiful flowers and everything will be destroyed. So you have to take out the weeds. You know, that is violence. That is even when you excrete. Now, millions of bacteria are being excreted every day, and then you are flushing that. So how many bacteria, you say, from tomorrow, I'm not going to excrete. Why? Because I want to be non-violent. You can't. So the point is that one cannot live without non-violence. Like, you know, in the Northeast, I don't know if you have this problem in Southwest, but we have this problem of ants. And lately, I haven't seen them, but I remember there was a time when every once a week or once or twice a month, suddenly the whole kitchen would be full of 200, 300 ants. You know, from where they come from a hole in the ground because there's an ant hill in Northeast Bakersfield. So what do you do if you say I'm nonviolent or God is in the ants? So do I not, you know, no, you have to. You have to spray. Otherwise, they're going to take over your whole kitchen. So physical violence is unavoidable. A surgeon, you know, there is a, your leg has gangrene and he amputates. If he amputates the leg, now that is violence. But he's amputating the leg to save your life. So the more important is not your action, but your mental attitude. Are you enjoying the violence? Like when I'm spraying the for the ants, if I say, oh, I'm so happy, I'm destroying all these ants, then that becomes violence. But if you say, oh, Lord, I know you are in these ants also, but, you know, they're taking over my house. I don't have a choice. I have to. So when you have that attitude, for no matter what you're doing, no matter whether you're taking out the weeds or whether you are, you know, cutting a leg, a surgeon doing a surgery, if he's, you know, anywhere when I'm doing violence, but my attitude is, oh, Lord, I know that this act is not right, but I don't have a choice. This is so having that attitude that, Lord, you are in all the weeds, you are in all the ants, you are, but I have to remove them. So the mental attitude is more important than the physical action. Like a mother disciplining a child, you know, suppose she, you know, they do a timeout or, you know, take away his favorite toy or even once in a while in an extreme case, even a slap, you know, not that you keep slapping every day just for, to digest your breakfast. No, not like that, but, you know, one day something happened and the child is not listening. Now, that action may appear violent, but it hurts the mother more than the child when she disciplines the child or when she slaps the child. And why does she do it? Because if I don't slap him or if I don't discipline him, then one day the world will do that. When he goes out into the world, if I don't teach him the right things, then one day the world will teach him the right things. And there's actually a very nice story that my mother had told me when I was little. It's a beautiful story. They said there was this man who was robbing an old couple's house. They had a lot of money and so and jewelry. So he was robbing. So he carried a gun with him and he was stealing things from that men couple when they were sleeping very quietly. And so it happened, they woke up and the old man came and got angry and tried to resist. So he had a gun, so he shot them both. So obviously, you know, committing a murder and, you know, with a gun in the act of robbery, in the act of felony is punishable by death. So he was condemned to be killed, to be put to death. And so as it happens, you know, he went through all the appeals and it was a premeditated act of murder. So nothing worked. So he was going to be put to death by injection or whatever the means was. So they asked him any last wish. You know, they usually ask any last wish you have. He said, yeah, my last wish is I'd like to see my mother. And so his mother, she was kind of older, so she was brought and she said, you know, he wants to see you as his last act before he, you know, before we condemn him to death. And so the mother was brought and he said, I want to talk to her closely, not through a glass. And they said his last wish, let him have it. So she came and he said, I want to say something in her ear, softly in her ear. So they said, okay. So the mother comes. So he bites her ear as hard as he can so he can take out blood and she gets so much pain. And you know, is that what you want to do to your mother before death? He says, yes. Well, what I am here today is because of my mother. I remember when I was age 5, I stole a pencil from a neighbor's house, from my friend's, and she didn't tell me anything. She said, it's okay, you know, child will outgrow. Then every year, every few months, I would steal something or the other from some neighbor or some friend. And she let me get by. Okay, he's a kid, let him. And so that's how I grew to become a robber like that. So she's responsible for where I am. So the point is that, you know, that the violence that a mother may, or a father, you know, to discipline a child, it's not that they enjoy hurting the child, but they feel that if we don't discipline the child, then the child will grow up to be a problem. So that's why they say violence is mental, not physical. What is your attitude? Are you enjoying what you're doing or you are saying, look, I am not happy about it, but I don't have a choice. So that's why ahimsa is to be practiced non, with a mental attitude. Talking about non-violence, we have a seminar. I think some of you who are on my email list will be getting it. If not, let me know towards the end of this month. They have a seminar on March 27, 28, 29, talking about non-violence, for comparing Mahatma Gandhi to Martin Luther King. So if you're interested, please let me know. I'll send you the email. But if you are getting the Chinmaya Meditation Group email, you'll be getting it next week. The next value is Satyam, or truthfulness. Truthfulness is in thought, speech, and action. What it means is that what I think, what I speak, and what I say are all congruent, are all one. It's not that I think something else and I speak something else and I do something else. So being able to practice oneness, and in that case, what happens is then you don't need to remember. Otherwise, what happens is if you have told somebody an untruth and then, you know, you afterwards you have told somebody else something else and a third person, then you have to remember, you know, whom did I tell what, when did I tell. So then you have so much stress, so much problems. So being able to practice that, the ability to practice the oneness, that I do not tell untruths. Yeah, you know, that as far as possible. Of course, sometimes, like we had talked about, you may have to be diplomatic, you know, somebody, you know, not to hurt somebody's feelings. But by and large, like the example, the story we had told one time before, is that suppose you are sitting and, you know, a woman comes running and then she says, oh, this man is chasing me, he's going to rape me. And then she goes and hides behind a bush or a tree. Now, if the man comes and says, have you seen this woman? Now, if you are honest, you say, yeah, she's hiding behind the bush. Then, you know, that is an act of violence. So there, in that kind of a situation, you may say, oh, I haven't seen, or something like that. But by and large, practicing truthfulness is a very, very important value, because unless you do that, your mind cannot be at peace. And a lot of negative karmas are developed by practicing untruthfulness. And we practice it in so many ways. You know, we practice it in our behavior, practice it in our finances, practice it in our practice dealing with patients, you know, with customers. So one has to be very conscious about truthfulness and not again, you know, not hurting anybody. Because when you are lying, when you're cheating, then, you know, you are hurting that person, especially when that is found out and there is a sense of betrayal. Oh, he lied to me, he cheated me. So they are all connected, you know. Non-violence and truthfulness are both very well connected. In fact, Mahatma Gandhi built his whole career, his whole life, on practicing these two values to the 100%. To the 100th percentile, he practiced non-violence and truthfulness. And that's what they say, you know, there are 26 values, and you say it's very hard to practice all. So one way is, as we talked about last week, is you practice one value a day. Okay, 26, there are 30 days in the month, so 26 values I practice, one each day. Today I'm going to practice truthfulness, today I'm going to practice non-violence. Or other option is pick two or three of these important values and practice them to the nth degree, to the absolute maximum. And then that's how you can live, because they're all connected. Once you practice non-violence, then absence of anger comes right away. When you practice truthfulness, you will be able to renounce and detach, tyaga. So they're all very much connected. Once you have the right knowledge, then you'll get purity of mind. So these values are all very well connected, and practicing one will bring all of them together. In fact, Mahatma Gandhi made a very interesting quote, which not too many people know about. He says that, I refuse to allow the dirt of other people's feet to pollute my mind. My sadhana is that I do not allow the dirt of other people's feet to come into my mind. So his idea was that I should practice truthfulness, but suppose tomorrow somebody else is telling something which is lies, or something which is wrong, or something which is untruthful, I do not let my mind get polluted by that. So I create a little barrier that I do not need to believe. And one of the important things of truthfulness is, do you have personal experience of that? See, a lot of times we say, oh, somebody said it, you know, especially gossip, you know, somebody said to somebody, and then somebody passed it on third and fourth hand, and by the time you get it, it's so convoluted. And then you yourself put your own masala, put your own, you know, ingredients, and then you spread it. So that lies keep on spreading. So one has to be very cautious about gossip. And especially if you watch the TV and newspaper, there's full of gossip, full about gossip about Bollywood stars, and Hollywood stars, and all kind. And why do we need to pollute our mind with, even if it's some people say, oh, you know, I watched it on TV or I saw it on the internet. It does not mean if it's on the internet, everything is truthful. I can put anything on, you know, Wikipedia, anybody can add to it on the internet. Even in the, so you say, oh, I watched it in Fox News. But Fox News has their own agenda. You know, they are so extreme to the right that they ignore any news that is not to their philosophy. And same thing, the left, liberal media, you know, some of the media like MSNBC is so liberal that only they show news that is conducive to their way of thinking. Anything that is not conducive, they will either ignore or they will put it down. So just because you saw it on TV or read it on the newspaper or watched it on the internet, it's okay. You take it with a grain of salt, but do I know for a fact that this is true? Only then you repeat it. Otherwise, be silent. Especially then they say, you know what will happen when you go to parties? Nobody will talk. Which is true, because in parties, what do they talk? Oh, CNN said this and internet said, and so-and-so said this. So it's all, and so there will be less convert. That is good. There will be silence. And silence is so good. You know, silence is what makes you go deep, what makes you go inward. Because most of the conversation is all second-hand, third-hand information. If you do not personally know about it, do not repeat it. So the point is that once you practice that, then automatically the two are connected. Automatically your speech will be non-violent, it will be truthful, and there will be a krodha, absence of anger. They are all connected. Because anger, what is anger? How does anger arise and what does it do? Let us analyze that. Anger does not arise all of a sudden. It's not that one fine day, suddenly I got angry. Anger is a gradual buildup. It's like a volcano when it erupts. Does it happen that one day everything was fine and second day, oh, we may see that. You know, you may see, okay, suddenly the volcano erupted and the whole lava is filling the, you know, the mountainside. But it has not happened overnight. Over months and years, the pressure was building up. In the fire, the heat was building up, and then one fine day it found a weak spot in the mountain, and you know, the volcano comes out, it erupts. So similarly, anger, even though we may think, oh, I suddenly got angry with this person or suddenly that person got angry, it is usually a gradual buildup. And most of the time when we get angry, it is not what the other person did, but what is inside happening to me. I may be unhappy about something, or I may be unhappy about myself. A lot of times people who don't like themselves, you know, they don't like, and so they're all the time irritated. You know, why do I like that? Or they may have some physical pain, a chronic back pain or headache or some chronic illness. So it is usually a physical or mental impurity in myself that creates anger. So I'm constantly irritated, but I don't say anything, and then somebody says something and say, oh, that person said something, I blew up. No, you blew up because you had this problem within you. So you have to look at the cause of the anger. Why did it build up? Why? And most of the time you will find that the problem is within you for which you got angry, not even though you blame a situation, my child did this or my spouse did this or my boss did this. So look for the cause of the anger and be very alert as to why I get angry. In fact, anger creates so much negative karmic load that it is really not worth it. It's not worth getting angry because you create so much negative karma within yourself. Again, I keep quoting Muniji. Whatever I heard from him, I made notes. I remember clearly. And he always used to say, never get angry with anybody. Now, that is very hard for us to practice. He's a Mahatma. Maybe he can do that. But for a person like you and me, it is very difficult. You know, why is anger bad? Because first of all, say, suppose you said, a person said something and you said it back. Oh, you know, so it's like an eye for an eye. So I heard a quotation, Swami Ishwarananda ji says, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. I take your eye, you take my, and goes back and forth. Ultimately, everybody will become blind. So anger should, you, most of the time, is a reaction. Is a reaction. Somebody said something and I reacted. So they say, do not react, but respond. Do not react, because anger is a reaction. Somebody said something and immediately I reacted. But do not react, but respond and see what the situation requires. And most of the time you will find that the same situation can be handled much better with softness, with, you know, pleasant speech than with anger. Because anger does two things. Like I said, you know, she gets angry at me, then I get angry at her, and it's back and forth. And then you keep adding up. So it multiplies. So that's number one. Number two, suppose you didn't act on the anger. You say, I got angry, but I kept it within me. But I was angry inside. But that also is negative. Like, say, suppose your boss, you don't like him and he's constantly on your tail, or your spouse or child or somebody, you know, you couldn't do anything about. But the person is constantly making you angry. And what you're doing is you're holding the anger inside, and it's building and building and building. It's doing more harm to you than to that person you may be angry at. That person may not even know it. Or even if the person knows it, but the more damage is within, because anger is just creating negative, you know, karmas, and you're raising your blood pressure, and it raises your heart rate and causes heart attacks. You know, physicians will tell you that anger is one of the very common causes of high blood pressure, all the stress-related physical problems, all the emotional disorders. And so that's why they say that anger should be controlled. And when anger arises, look for the cause. Why did I get angry, and why am I angry? And can I handle the situation without anger? But suppose I cannot. Now, suppose my child is misbehaving and I have talked to him nicely and he's not listening, or my employee in the office, you know, I've talked to them 2-3 times. So then Gurudev used to say, he had a very interesting phrase. He says, I keep anger in my pocket, I take it out, I use it, and I put it back. So the idea is that if at the last resort I have to use anger, don't become an angry person. Don't let your anger stay with you for all day, for hours, for weeks, for months. If a situation arises where I do have to scold a child or my employee, do that, but without any anger, without any malice, without any hatred. Maybe you may have to use some strong words, but inside your mind should be cool. And then instantly the ability to drop the anger, that's what Gurudev had. If he found a situation where he really needed to use anger, you know, as a last resort, he would tell people nicely. But I remember one time in one of the mission centers, he was telling them to build a place and they wouldn't. You know, they kept saying, oh, land is expensive, building is expensive, this is expensive. And for months and years, he was, and then one fine day, I remember in a public, he had told them even privately, they went in a public, after dinner, there were about 200 people, and he got the board of directors of that center, and he really blasted them. He said, I've been telling you for years, it's such a big city, and you're telling me you can't afford to build, and after that, immediately, they got so scared. By next year, the center, when he came, the center was ready. Not only that, but since then, the center has multiplied 5 or 6 times because the demand was there, but they were just afraid and they were not ready to. So the point is that in his situation was, if he did get angry, he would instantly calm down. And next time somebody's talking to him, next minute, he's full of smiles. So I may have to use anger as a last resort, but do not become an angry person. Do not let the anger take over you. Do not become angry. Yes, I had to use it and then put it back in your pocket and then drop it. And then do not hold the grudge against that person that, you know, this person was like that. Okay, and in fact, If anything, you may later on want to apologize. I'm sorry I was angry, but I had to do it. So that is called absence of anger, and seeing the reason why we get angry, that has to be very important. That has to be covered. I'll pause here for a few minutes. Anybody has any comments about these three values? Ahimsa, Satyam, Akrodha, or any other points you want to bring up about values?
You're saying about the thoughts. Sometimes it's like really difficult to like hold like thoughts. Like example, there was like angry customer who came at home and we don't take the insurance.
I think how your reaction, I think you reacted appropriately. In my mind, you know, you didn't get angry. Yeah, you didn't get angry to him. You didn't say anything that would provoke. You brought the manager in. Tomorrow, you could even make a computer note that this person should not be served in the pharmacy. You know, we don't want such a patient. You know, because out of 10,000 patients, if you lose one, or in a doctor's office, if somebody acts like that, you just fire them from the practice. You don't need somebody. Right. Right. Or if you have security, you know, if you have security in your. Otherwise. Right, right.
But I'm saying, like, how could you stop your thoughts? Like, I mean, like,
no, you can't.
That's a negative thought, like
right,
against him.
Right.
Or like if you got hurt, like you're like smiling to yourself and to your manager, and that's.
It's good
not,
he got hurt. Yeah.
But it's right. Yeah, I mean, like you're showing anger and you want to be, but like.
Yeah, no, I know, but that's right. But what the point is that if you had got angry and spoken something violent, that would have provoked him further and made it into a violent. He might have gone and brought a gun, or you don't know. So I think you handled it appropriately, that not getting angry, handle it situation. But in the later on, you can fix it so that this person doesn't come to the pharmacy. You can say, okay, from now on,
manager
this
said, keep a note.
That yeah, that he should not be served in this pharmacy, or, you know, things like that. So, no, I think, but
kind of people, I get,
right.
But like, it's hard like to control, like, do like the, you're not, your thoughts and everything, your emotions.
Right.
It's hard like to control. How could you handle those kind of emotional?
Right. Also, I think in the healthcare field, we deal with people who are unhappy.
Yeah.
See,
mentally sick, physically sick.
Yeah.
And we deal with people who are actually are either hurting, or they're angry at the world, or they're unemployed, or they don't have a job. But if you handle it correctly, sometimes I have an example. There was one patient who came to see me. He had actually been thrown out of three doctor's offices. One place they actually had called the police to evict him because he was that much bothersome. He used to harass them. And I actually, surprisingly, I talked to him nicely and I sat him down, and he was the same way, very, you know, as a demanding. And then I took care of him. Actually, afterwards, he told everybody that, you know, that he's the best doctor and he always comes back. And even when he moved, he would come back to see me and he would tell so many people. So the point is that the person was unhappy because he was physically not well. His family had rejected him from New York. They didn't want him to come. So he was a very unhappy person. And so every doctor, because he would act like that, nobody has time to deal with. They said, get him out of my office, you know. So, but sometimes if you can talk to them nicely, spend a little time with them. Even my employees were surprised. They say, you know, how did you... This guy has changed. He's such a different individual. I think if you use some compassion for them and realize why they are unhappy, maybe you could change them, but not somebody like that.
Violent. Violence is hard,
yeah.
But, like, yes.
But I'm just saying.
Helplessness you can
right,
change, but
right,
violent
right,
behavior
right.
is hard.
It's hard, yeah, I know that.
And
but I'm just giving.
Schizophrenic? Oh,
right.
That scares me.
True.
They come at night.
That's already
one
condition.
Shoes, huh?
That's a condition, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel bad, but the other side, I mean, like,
really?
I think the way to get over that is, suppose somebody has been very hurtful to you. If you're getting angry, you're just, you know, potentiating or, you know,
multiplying.
You just say, Lord, you know, you are the, you know, the giver of all karmas. You will take care of him. And ultimately, we all get the results of our karma. You cannot escape that.
Right.
Absolutely. It's 100% guaranteed. So if somebody is doing negative, why should I create more negative karmas by getting angry? I just dedicate to the Lord. Okay, Lord, I know you will take care of it. And then automatically your anger will become less. Because in fact, sometimes you feel compassion that this person is hurting himself. Like now these people who commit all these horrible acts, you know, in the Middle East and all that. These, you know, I sometimes feel that what negative karmas they're creating. They're slaughtering children and raping women and. And, you know, there was this one tribe that they would throw people up in the air and then spear them. And all. oh yeah, and they describe it in the TV and the newspaper. And I say, these people don't realize how much negative karma, how much they are going to suffer when they're randomly doing it to just all kinds of people. So, but see, people don't realize, but then next life when they suffer, then they say, oh, what did I do, Bhagwan? Why am I suffering? But the fact is that anything that is happening to us, and most of the time in this life itself, you get 90 or 95% of your karmas. Few of them are carried on. So when it is happening, instead of saying, why is it happening to me? You understand, I must have done something either in this life or previous life to deserve it. Nothing happens to anybody without a reason. Nothing. There is never anything happening. If anything is happening to me, good or bad, I am responsible. Once you know that, then there is there's nobody to blame. Then there is nobody to get angry at.
But at that minute, you have a negative thought.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I said. But don't carry it.
No, you try to like cover it up, but
right.
It's still like...
No, no, you see, you cannot 100% control your thoughts, it's up to you whether you feed it. Say the thought arose,
and
a negative thought. How long do you feed it and you keep multiplying it?
Or you're prolonging or...
Right, right. Are you feeding the thought or...
Where is it coming from? I mean, what you said is, you know, there's no other way, you have to do it. Then it should not be a ahimsa then.
It's not himsa then. Yeah, it's mental. If your attitude is not to hurt them, it's not, then it is not, it is not, it is,
yeah.
It is required. It is ahimsa. It's not himsa then. When you're plucking a weed or one killing an ant that is filling your kitchen and you're spraying that, as long as your attitude is that this is something I have to do, God is in all these ants, but I don't have a choice, and you're not enjoying that, then it is not himsa, yes. Because every room in the house should be a prayer room. True, yeah. No, no, but like in a church or a temple, if you happen to see ants crawling, will you not kill them? You still have to. Yeah, suppose that there are a whole row of ants in the temple, right, going to Krishna's feet and, you know, going up. You have to, you know. Yeah, you have to. Even though Krishna created all those ants, but he doesn't want them either. See, so, yeah. Anything else? We'll do a few.
Anger touched most of us today.
I know. Anger is because it's a very common thing, very common problem. And since I listened to Muniji, he made me so aware of, he used to every time talk about gussa nahi karna, gussa nahi. And it makes such an impact on you, you know. It's hard to control it, but at least you become conscious about the negative effects of anger. Yes. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we deal with it a lot more. People are angry at us, somebody is, you know, most of the time because they are unhappy people. Yeah, they don't want to be there.
Yeah.
You know, they're hurting, and then they want to blame somebody or the other, you know. Yeah.
They have to live with it every day.
Yeah.
Right.
And they have to do what they are doing.
Right, right. That's true. It's even more difficult for them. Right. But that's why they shoot. They shoot first before they get shot.
No question.
Before they get shot. Again, it's a very fine line, you know. Like the two policemen were shot. They were just doing their duty. So, you know, in Missouri, and they were trying to control the crowd. So it's very hard. You're right. It's a very delicate situation. And what happens first? Today, even in the newspaper, there was an article. So you don't know. You know, there are two sides to everything. It's very difficult.
But what is it?
He was doing his duty because these people were a cancer upon society. It's like when you're cutting a leg that has cancer. That's not himsa. So same way, he was removing and Krishna actually encouraged him. He said, these people are going to be a cancer upon, unless you remove them, they will create negativity. So they had to be removed.
Right.
Yeah, so, but you're right. That's a good point.
Kill them with kindness.
Yeah, as long as in your mind, he actually had no malice towards any of them. He did not hate anybody, but as a duty, he did. That's what he says at the end of the 18th chapter. I shall do what you say. Now I have know what my duty is. In the first chapter, he said, I'm not going to. He put his gun deep down. He said, I can't fight. Why? Because I'm killing all my, you know, relatives and all. But at the end, he said, I understand what my duty is. You have taught me that. So Krishna did not change the situation, change his mind. That's what the spiritual knowledge does, changes our thinking. The situation will still remain the same. Your spouse, your boss, your co-workers, your things happening at work, they will all remain the same, but your way of looking at the world changes. And that is the only benefit of it. And then you handle the same situation much better, I think.
You know, one time the lady was like throwing like coins like a chip after I served her in drive-through.
Right.
Yeah, I said, like, you know what, you got her, not me.
Make them wonder.
Right. Now let's go to Tyaga. Tyaga is a very beautiful value. Renunciation, and people always think Tyaga is something terrible. Why do I have to give up? You know, Tyaga means we think it is terrible. I have to suffer. I have to give up. But the point is that to evolve or to grow up, you have to practice renunciation. Without renunciation, you will not evolve. You will not grow up. See, there is a difference. Last week we talked about dana. Dana is charity. In dan, you give what you don't need, or say you have excess of. Say I have excess of money or whatever, I give. But in tyaga, you give up what you like. In dana, you may give away what you don't need or what you don't have like. But in tyaga, what is renunciation? Giving up what I like. And that people say, oh, forget that. That's why I don't come to Gita class. Because they tell me to give up what I don't like. But the point is that to evolve or to grow, otherwise what happens is that you will keep on doing what you're doing. If there is something you like, you keep on enjoying it, indulging it. Then it becomes a more bondage. Like I like sweets. So I eat a lot of sweets. And then next week I don't get sweets. Then the desire comes in my mind. You know, I need to have sweets. So then I go to the store and buy more sweets. And then I buy more sweets, then I get more enjoyment. So the enjoyment leads to desire, desire leads to more enjoyment. So it becomes a vicious cycle on and on. And sooner I know it, I have this intense vasana, for intense desire for sweets. So the vasanas grow from indulgence. When I excessively indulge, tyaga does not mean that you shouldn't enjoy anything, but it should not become such an addiction or such a habit that I cannot live without it. And it could be anything. It could be food, it could be drinks, it could be alcohol, smoking, it could be, you know, some people have excessive desire for money. I must have money at all costs. Some people have excessive desire for power. So anything that is excessively controlling your mind and your thinking is a problem. So tyaga is to renounce, to give up, to grow out of. I don't really need it. Why should I let this inanimate object control me? And that's why they, in all our scriptures, they like in Easter time, for 1 month, they give up something they like. So the idea is you develop self-control. In Islam also, when the rose, they fast. Even in Hinduism, they do fasting, you know, for one day a month. Or sometimes when people go to Gangaji, go to Banaras, they give up one thing they liked, you know, like, okay, today I gave up sweets. So, and giving up, like Swamiji jokes, he says, he doesn't like eggplant. So he says, you cannot go and say, I'm going to give up eggplant from that. Yeah. Something you don't enjoy, you give up. That's not tyaga. It is giving up what you enjoy. And the reason is not to forcefully deprive myself, but to grow out of. And tyaga comes very easily when you see the benefit, that it is for a higher purpose I'm doing it. It's like a girl, you know, she's very attached to her toy and her little doll. And then after a while, she's attached to her bike. Nobody can touch my bike. Nobody can touch my doll. But then when she turns 16, she gets a Toyota or a Honda. Then does she have any fascination for the doll or for the bike? They automatically fall off. Why? Because now she got a car. So similarly, when I'm attached to objects, emotions, and thoughts because of my intense desire and vasanas, but as my mind turns more and more towards the Lord, then automatically things drop off. And I think one of the ladies who comes to the meditation class, she was talking about it. She says, since she has been coming for 2-3 years, she has no interest in going to parties and staying out late. And her friends are all telling her, you know, you are becoming a boring person. You're not any fun. But she said, I don't enjoy that. I don't enjoy going to a bar and staying till 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock with my friends. She said, I don't even hang out with those friends. If I have extra time in the evening, I just stay home and read and meditate. She herself was saying that. And so the point is that when you get something better, and we think that tyaga is going to make me suffer, it's not. When you find something better, the joy of the Lord, of spiritual growth, is so much greater than these paltry little joys of the world. They automatically drop off. automatically. Tyaga is not renunciation, forceful. Yeah, that little girl, if you had forcefully taken her doll, she would have cried, or forcefully taken her bike. But you gave her a car, then she said, you can have my bike. Her doll, she gives to the little her friend. Bike. Now she can go and hang out with her friends. The doll or the bike easily drops. She gives it to her little sister. So similarly, when a person finds something higher, then tyaga comes automatic. It just drops off automatic. There's another lady who comes to the meditation class. She says she used to go to the Valley Plaza 3 times a week. I had mentioned that. And now she says for the last 2 years, she has not even gone to the mall. She says she doesn't need, she has enough clothes. Why go there? She used to just shop unnecessarily. So the point is that you don't have to force somebody, but tyaga happens automatically. Actually, there is a very beautiful phrase which talks about glory of tyaga. It's in the Upanishads, and we all chant it. You know, whenever Swamiji's come, we offer them the Purna Kumbha, the coconut with on that plate. And then we chant, Na karmana, na prajaya, dhane, na tyage, naike, amritatva, ma, na shuhu. So he says that for amritatvam, for the spiritual unfoldment, to become a spiritually evolved person, amritatvam means immortality. Immortality does not mean living forever. Immortality means realizing my immortal nature, that I am actually that immortal self, the Om, the Brahman, who at this moment is playing a role, whether whatever Pankaj or Anil or whatever name I have been given, whatever form I have taken, male or female, but actually I am that spiritual. So amritatvam is recognizing that. But he says that cannot happen by karmana, na prajaya, na dhanena. Because in the world, when you want to acquire anything I want to acquire, these are the three means, either self-effort, help of others, or money. If you think about it, anything you want to acquire, these three things you need, either one or the other. For example, suppose I'm standing for election, right? I'm standing for city council. Now I want to win the election. So what do? Either self-effort. I myself go and visit each home, shake everybody's hand and get to know people and, you know, walk the streets. So that is one way, self-effort. And I spend months, you know, start a year or 2 years ahead and I win the election. But I didn't take the help of anybody. But suppose now my area is huge, like I'm standing for supervisor. So not only my area is Bakersfield, Kern County, but up to Ridgecrest. Now I cannot go to Ridgecrest every day. I cannot go to, you know, all these far Bishop, all these far communities. So what do? I take the help of others. Maybe I know the mayor of Ridgecrest, or I know some city councilman, or I know some prominent people. So I ask them, you know, can you help me? So they help me. So I get the help of others to win. Or I use money. Okay, I have millions of dollars. So the TV I fill with ads, you know, all over from here to Ridgecrest, to Bishop, to Kern County, everywhere. My ads are in all the TV, newspapers, all the hoardings. Then I win with the help of money. So anything you want to acquire in the world, you can acquire by one of these three means. But it says, na karmana, na prajaya. Karmana, na prajaya, help of others. Dhanena. Tyage naike. Only with tyaga alone, you can get immortality. So they say, what do you mean by that? If I want to become a spiritually evolved individual, and I want to become realized, become one with God, can I do it with self-effort? Well, self-effort can only take you so far, through meditation, through service, through prayer, through helping others. But then ultimately there comes a phase where the self-effort does not work. Then the Lord's grace is required. So you say, God, I have done what I could. Now the rest is up to you. And then he actually comes and picks you up. That's why in the 12th chapter he says, Tesham aham samuddharta mrityu samsar sagarat. Bhavami nachirat partha maya aveshit chetasam. So one who has put his mind and intellect on me, maya aveshit chetasam, then I lift them up. So self-effort can take you part way, but you cannot reach. So self-effort fails. Ultimately, you have to surrender. Bhagavan, now you take it over. It's your job. I have done the best I could. Okay, how about help of others? Like Guru. Can Guru give you self-realization? They say no. Guru cannot, no matter how evolved the guru is, unless you have put the effort and unless God's grace is there, even the guru cannot. And sometimes some gurus do promise, you know, you come to me and I will take you there. So Swami Chinmayananda used to say, I am not a mule. I am not a mule guru. You cannot ride on my back and I'll carry you up there. You have to do it. And ultimately, the grace of God has to be there. And grace of God only will come when you have the self-effort, sincere effort. But ultimately, the surrender has to come. Otherwise, the ego comes. You know, I am so great. I'm such a great dhani. I've given so much charity. I do so much puja. I do so much meditation. And none of these guys are as good as me. So ego comes. So the ego has to be surrendered. The self-effort has to go. And then ultimately, the ego has to go. And then the Lord comes. So guru cannot help you. Scriptures, they all can guide you. I'm not saying that guru is not useful. Whatever little I know is because of the grace of Swami Chinmayananda and all the gurus. So gurus can give us right knowledge. Books can guide us. Scriptures can help us. But ultimately, I have to put in my effort and then ultimately surrender even the doership that I am doing anything, that I am a devotee, I am a servant of the Lord. Even that has to go, that I and my has to disappear for the Lord to function through me. So, Tyaga, you give up that I and my. And how about money? Obviously, with money, you can buy things on the world, but you cannot buy spirituality. You cannot buy God with, you know, money. Or maybe you can do a lot of charity. That is good. But again, what that will do is quieten your mind. If you do the charity with the right attitude of service, you know, as a Lord servant, that's good. But then you still have to get the knowledge. You still have to put in the self-effort. Then ultimately, you have to give up the ego. The Lord then takes over. So that's why the glory of Tyaga has been beautifully explained in that verse. And then he says, Padena nakam nihitam guhayam vibhrajate yat yatayo vishanti. So he says this glory of spiritual evolution is even beyond heaven. Parena nakam. Nakam is heaven. It is beyond heaven. And people always think heaven is the highest. You know, once you go to heaven, you are eternally happy. But our scriptures tell us heaven is a luxurious place where you go to enjoy your pleasures. You enjoy it and then you come back. So this glory of self-realization is even higher than heaven. And where is it? Vibhrajate. Nihitam guhayam. In your heart, it shines. Vibhrajate. Yat yataya vishanti. And the wise seekers enter that. So when they say heart, they don't mean the pumping heart that pumps the blood. When they say heart, they mean the core of my personality, where all the good values like love, compassion, kindness, softness. So where those values are strong, there that the Lord shines. And so these wise people detach from the world and turn inward to the Lord's presence where He's shining. The Lord is shining and it is because of that that I am able to function. So that joy can only be had by renunciation, by tyaga. I give up my attachments. It does not mean that you give up all your objects and become a sadhu. No, but I do not need these objects to make me happy because I found something higher. And that we'll talk a little more when we do talk about shanti. So any more comments about tyaga, about renunciation?
So what would be, I guess, the two things probably are related, tapa and tyaga?
Yes. All of these values are connected. All of these values are connected. That's why Krishna has sequentially given them. Each one is connected to the other. Like after tyaga, you get shanti. See, when I have do not desire objects to make me happy, then I become more peaceful. And tapa also, yeah. Tapa and tyaga are very connected, yes. I practice austerities and then I give up, yes. Yeah. So they are all connected. All of these values are connected. Okay, we can talk about shanti. I think then we have about 5 minutes and then we'll end today. So shanti is peace. And it's a most beautiful word. The moment you say shanti, shanti, instantly your mind becomes peaceful, or you say peace, peace, peace. It's such a beautiful word that one should just repeat it. And in our scriptures, you know, we chant shanti. They say when we end our any session, class, any prayer, we say shanti, shanti, shanti 3 times. Because in life, There are three kinds of obstacles that come. Why do we chant Shanti three times? Because there are three kinds of problems or obstacles can come. One is obstacles come from the nature, like earthquakes, you know, flooding, drought, thunderstorms. So obstacles coming from nature, that is number one. You know, like, you know, everything is going fine, earthquake comes, your whole house is destroyed. So first Shanti is, oh Lord, may there not be obstacles from nature. Because, you know, nature is you know, has its own, you know, ways. That's how she functions. So one is problems from nature. Second is problems from the surroundings, from my neighbor, from my spouse, from the government. You know, I'm a Democrat, so I don't like the Republican government. Or I'm a Republican, I don't like the government, you know, Democratic. So problems can come from the government, can come from the neighbor, from my friend, from my family, from my children. So that is the second obstacle. And the third and the most important is obstacles come from within, from my own mind. My own mind disturbs me. I get disturbed. So when I say Shanti three times, oh Lord, may there not be problems in the cosmos. May there not be problems in my surroundings. And then may my mind be calm. May there not be problems within me. So the ability to remain equanimous in all situations is called Shanti. Because it, again, as we said, it does not mean, Shanti does not mean that I do not have objects. But if I have something, it's fine. And tomorrow, if I lose it, I'm still fine. That equanimity, and to understand that in life, things are not always going to be good. Today there is joy, tomorrow there will be sorrow. It is guaranteed. And today there is sorrow, tomorrow there will be joy. So the ability to remain equanimous in all situations is called Shanti. So Shanti is again a state of mind, which again comes, which is connected to renunciation. When I do not have attachment for things, then tomorrow if I have it, I enjoy it, fine. If I don't have it, it's okay. It was not meant for me. And when a person is like that, you find that his mind is very peaceful. It reflects the Lord, like there is a lake, if you're, you know, sitting by a lake, and the lake is very quiet, there is no wind, and the water is clean, and the mountains are there in the background, and the trees beautifully, you can see everything reflected so nicely. But if that lake is very agitated with wind and, you know, a lot of dirt and mud, then you can't see the mountain. So similarly, a person whose mind is very shant, very peaceful, very equanimous, the Lord is reflected very clearly in that. That's why when we are in the presence of these Mahatmas, you feel a lot of peace because they radiate peace, because the Lord himself is there. So the quieter our mind, the closer that you are to the truth, the more the consciousness will reflect. So consciously develop Shanti, develop peacefulness, develop a peaceful attitude where should be peaceful in my thought, peaceful in my speech, peaceful in my actions. So, and remain equanimous no matter what life throws us, because life is not always going to be the same. So the ability to remain peaceful is Shanti. And it's a very, very beautiful value. And as we said, they're all connected. Each of them is Ahimsa, Satyam, all of them are Akrodha. Like if I have anger, how can I be Shant? So they are all connected. Tyaga is connected and all that. So this is what we have covered so far. Any comments on this? That's what they say. Directly. Right. Pick up two or three values and practice them 100%, and the other 26 will come. They will all automatically come. That's what Mahatma Gandhi's life, you know, as we said, he practiced Ahimsa and Satyam. Two, and everything else came. Control of the mind, control of the senses, kandama, everything comes. You know, charity, dhanam, everything comes. So that's why each one is connected with the other. That's how there's a sequence we find in these 26 values.